Hi, this is Jean Bruce Scott.
And Randy Reinholz.
And when we're not busily producing some of the most outstanding Native American theater in Los Angeles,
we always like to check out the best of British audio adventures with Alex Lefchuk and his team of the Midweek Drive.
And Midweek Drive morning editions on Siren FM.
And southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com.
One of the quotes which certainly has stuck with me over the years, ever since I actually entered the august profession of teaching, and indeed university and indeed standard comprehensive work, was George Bernard Shaw's, "Those who can do, those who can't teach." I didn't agree with it then, I don't agree with it now. And certainly it's one of those aspects which it's good to see many final year university students and recent graduates are considering the teaching profession, with a number of them, in fact, nearly three quarters, feeling they ought to future-proof their career prospects by searching in an established or growing sector where their subject knowledge and skills are in demand. So to talk us through why teaching could be exactly what people are looking for, and not just the cliched rewarding profession, although that's one of the key things about it, we're delighted to welcome two wonderful folk. First of all, a spokesperson for the Get Into Teaching campaign and a national leader of education. That's Roger Pope. How are you, Roger?
I'm really well, thank you. And it's a great pleasure to be with you today.
Excellent, and good to have you. Obviously, we've also got ACE career coach Alice Stapleton. How are you, Alice?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Delighted, Alice. Now, let's turn to Roger first. In terms of this particular survey, teaching has it tends to sort of be one of those professions which either gets attacked regularly or generally put down, or then, of course, we hear about rewarding teaching, but it is something which is really an important aspect of our whole aspect as human beings, isn't it, Roger?
It absolutely is. And it's one of those professions where you get the occasional sort of story in the papers, but actually you talk to the vast majority of parents and the vast majority of pupils, and they're really happy with their local school and are really thriving there. And the amazing thing about teaching as a profession is that the cliche is true. You really do shape the lives of other people day in, day out. And you really do go home at the end of every day feeling as though you have actually made a difference to young people, because you have so many interactions with them in the course of a day. And yes, it's hard work, but it's also immensely satisfying.
Alice, you specialise with young people in their 20s and 30s. Have you noticed a particular change in terms of people saying, actually, teaching could well be for me?
It's definitely a career that comes up a lot in the work that I do, because, as you alluded to, a lot of people in their 20s and their 30s, they are looking for something that is rewarding, that gives them a sense of purpose, that they can feel proud to say that that's what they do. They don't really want to be chained behind a computer 9 to 5. I think since the pandemic, there's a real sense that they want to serve their community in some way. So no surprises that teaching comes to the front of their mind as a career to consider, absolutely.
And Roger, in terms of the attractions of teaching, we've talked about inspiring people. That's one of those intangible things which is always difficult to quantify. And in these days of having to measure everything, it seems as though we obviously need to assess these things. Is it that sort of notion that somehow you are genuinely making a difference to our fellow travellers on the planet Earth?
Yes, I think it is, because actually, you don't have to be in conversation with somebody long before they can start talking about teachers that they had when they were at school who had a profound impact on them. I had a teacher, I had an English teacher who enthused a group of us with, would you believe it, opera, which was a fairly odd kind of thing, but he did. And I came from a family where there was no music being played in the house. There was no access to that. And he took a group of us to see an opera in London, and that stayed with me for my whole life. And then I took a group of children once to the opera in the Bristol Hippodrome, actually. And there were they were all sitting in a row, and I noticed him at the back of the theatre. He was there as well. So I went back to him and I said to him, "See that row of children down there? They're here because of you." And so you really do those that sense of having an impact is real and tangible.
This is the classic ripple effect. Alice, what drew you into becoming a career coach? Was it, again, were you inspired by a teacher that kind of led you into providing advice for others?
Well, I was certainly inspired by a coach that I worked with. And I think, I mean, that spectrum along helping others and making a difference. Of course, there are a variety of careers that fit that bill, I suppose. I do certainly remember some of my teachers. I do remember a particular physics session where a teacher was explaining the sort of infinity of the universe and my mind just being slightly blown at the age of 10, realizing that we are floating around in infinity. So it is just that impact that is quite special and quite unique to that profession. But I think coaching has similar veins in terms of being able to help other people and make a difference.
And Roger, returning back to this survey for Get Into Teaching, are people listening to this particular item and maybe drawn to thinking more solidly about a career in teaching and so on, what advice would you have for them?
My advice would be to put the three words Get Into Teaching into your search engine. That will take you to our website, and there you can get access to all the information that you need to help you take the next steps. So it will tell you all about the various training courses that are on offer right across the country, so you can do it anywhere that suits you. Talks about the salaries that you can expect, so you can start on a salary between 25 and 32,000 now, depending on where in the country you are. And it can also tell you about the events that we run across the country, live events that you can go to in person, and you can talk to teachers at those events, you can talk to advisors, and they will help answer all your questions and help you with the next steps. So just those three words, Get Into Teaching, into your search engine, and off you go.
Perfect. And Alice, presumably you'd echo that particular advice. And for undergraduates or indeed possibly even graduates who are listening to this, who may be thinking about that first step, would you also counsel to go Get Into Teaching on their browsers?
Absolutely. And I'd highly recommend taking up the opportunity of speaking to other teachers where you can and getting a really get a deep insight into what it's like to actually be in the classroom and part of that profession, so you can really test drive that career and get a good sense of what's involved and what to expect as you get into it.
Alice Stapleton, career coach, and indeed Roger Pope, spokesperson for the Get Into Teaching campaign and the National Leader for Education. Huge thanks and happy pedagogical practicing days.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, holidays around the corner. In fact, in many cases, they could already have started. But more than a third of British holidaymakers say that eating a full English breakfast is a highlight of their holiday. Okay. A quarter like eating chips when they go away, and 16% say they tuck into greasy or fried food more so than they would if they were at home. So clearly, this is not leading to good gut health, potentially. And to actually talk about this, we're delighted to welcome health dietitian extraordinaire, Lucy Carrison. How are you, Lucy?
Hi, Alex. I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Well, delighted to connect with the good self. Now, we know that these kinds of foods groups and foodings aren't necessarily good for us. They don't actually help our particular ways forward. So, clearly there are problems, and particularly, obviously, there is that traditional British line, particularly if we're going overseas, saying, oh, I don't know, I don't really fancy trying those shellfish. That doesn't look good at all.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, there's some really interesting stats from Yakult as well. So they've shown that actually, a lot of Brits are more worried about the food value when they go away than they are about knowing the local language or the area. And all of these extra stats that you've, included about the types of foods that they'll be eating, completely agree they're not really the types of foods that are going to be feeding your gut bacteria or helping your gut health. So what we want to do is, enjoy the local cuisine, enjoy little treats and different types of foods when you're away, but also nourish your gut with some good healthy fibers, keeping up your exercise levels and getting a good night's sleep, for example.
So really, it's a case of following the same kind of regimes that we would do at home up to a point, but hopefully doing it in a more mindful, healthy way and not just saying, don't drink the water.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think one of the most important things for your gut and your gut health is consistency, and consistency in terms of fibres, consistency in terms of your portion size and regularity of meals. So what we want to avoid is huge fibre shifts and meal size changes when you're away. So what some people might do is, you know, usually have their porridge for breakfast at home and, you know, a salad or a pasta salad for lunch, and then they go away and they're having an English breakfast and an all-inclusive, and they're going to the buffet and having lots of different types of foods, which is lovely. But what we want to do is keep a little bit of consistency in terms of the fibers. So, you know, have your croissant or a bit of an English breakfast, but also have some fruit alongside it.
I was particularly surprised, as we mentioned, by the survey by Yakults, that 44% like to sample local delicacies, but, and this is the important one, 10% pack their favourite breakfast cereal, and 7% of us take tins of baked beans or spaghetti with them. Surely that's going to be a nightmare getting through customs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the potentially the baked beans is more for people on a staycation. And, you know, a little bit of baked beans are okay, but they're also quite high in salt. So what I'd recommend as a better snack to take with you are things like mixed nuts and seeds. You could, if you wanted to take a tin of beans, potentially take a tin of mixed salad beans that are tinned in spring water rather than the baked beans. Because we know in terms of gut health, it's all about diversity. And we want these different fiber groups, so your fruits, your veggies, your whole grains, nuts and seeds, beans and pulses. But within each group, we want as much diversity as possible. And this is what's going to really nourish your gut and continue to make you feel good once you're at home.
And that is really critical, because a slightly sobering thought is that more than a third of us have suffered stomach pain, cramps or diarrhea, whilst other ailments have been caused by holiday gluttony, including constipation, heartburn and headaches. I mean, none of these things are presumably things that we'd like to actually suffer from. So the best thing to do is to listen to our gut and give it some good health to actually work through and be on our side of the good bacteria.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's keeping the routine. So keeping active is a really nice way of preventing that holiday constipation that a lot of us can suffer with if we're changing our diets a lot. So if you're, you know, going on a staycation, see if there's any local hiking areas, or if you're staying in a hotel, having a dip in the pool or using the gym can be a really nice way to keep active, keep the gut muscles working and prevent that constipation.
For people who wish to find out more details about this Yakult survey, Lucy, where can they actually go?
Yeah, so you can visit the Yakult website, and we've got all the details in terms of the survey. We've got some gut health tips going up there, and all the information that you need will be on the Yakult website.
Lucy Kerrison, gut health dietitian extraordinaire, as ever, a delight and a pleasure. Keep on keeping on, and happy eating, Lucy.
Thanks, Alex. Happy eating to you too.
What can do? Could we have? the joys of the South, the joys of Louisiana in particular. Does it get any better when it comes to cuisine? Well, we're going to find out in terms of some of the happenings that are taking place when it comes to a summer soul of Louisiana heading to the UK. And to actually talk us through this, we're delighted to welcome Executive Chef from the Hummus House Plantation. That's Jeremy Langlois. How are you, Jeremy?
Hey, it's so good to be with you, Alex.
Fantastic. And we've also got Louisiana Seafood Cook-Off winner and indeed New Orleans, or technically New Orleans native, Brian Landry. How are you, Brian?
Doing very well. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. So, Jeremy, what is it about the quality of the cuisine in Louisiana that effectively over the last 300 years has kind of just produced quality across the base, more than just a gumbo?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Louisiana cuisine is, you know, when you think Louisiana, you think food. The two go hand in hand. You know, in fact, in the United States, there's few areas that isn't more pronounced than in Louisiana. And you're right, it's more than just gumbo. Louisiana is known as the sportsman's paradise, and that's because we have access to such a wide variety of different ingredients, whether it's the wonderful seafood that comes right out of the Gulf of Mexico, or we also have seafood that comes right out of the swamps and the freshwater as well. Plenty of fresh game and great game and hunting is just so prevalent in Louisiana. And then, you know, of course, you got to say crawfish as well. When you think of Louisiana, you think of crawfish. We love our crawfish. When the weather's hot outside, you know, a crawfish boil and a cold beer, it doesn't get any more Louisiana than that.
Now, Brian, you are obviously a supporter of regional foodways, dedicated conservationist of Gulf seafood. What is it about Louisiana food that makes it stand out for yourself?
Well, I think where we're located, where the Mississippi River connects with the Gulf of Mexico, creates this just wonderful breeding ground for so much different wildlife coming from the water. You know, we have such a just wide variety of different shrimp and oysters, finfish, all of it right there. And the part of the where the Mississippi and the Gulf meet, it's very nutrient rich water, which is why so many animals end up using South Louisiana as its breeding ground. So it's quite plentiful and bountiful, and we've worked it into our cuisine over the last couple of hundred years, as you mentioned, and it is a cuisine that's ever evolving as well.
Jeremy, we've spoken in previous packages about Louisiana and its superb musical outlets. And obviously, it's the place and location for jazz as well. But clearly, music is the food of love. If we're talking about Louisiana food, what can people expect when they make a visit to Louisiana partake of?
Well, I got to just say, get ready. You're going to be overwhelmed with options. You know, of course, if you're traveling and you've never been to Louisiana before, you have to get your bowl of gumbo. You have to experience jambalaya. You have to experience something like grits or etouffee. But also, I like to let people know as well, you know, sometimes Louisiana cuisine has this misnomer of just being something that's spicy and your mouth's going to be on fire the whole time. And that's just not the case. Of course, we love our Tabasco hot sauce and stuff like that. We enjoy some food with a kick sometime. But even like me as a chef, it's very rarely I use very little seasoning other than salt and pepper for most of the things I cook. But it's a well-seasoned cuisine, not necessarily spice, but seasoned. We love our onions, celery, bell pepper, garlic. It's in everything we cook. So the flavors are just absolutely bold.
You were made the youngest executive chef at any distinguished restaurants of North America at age of 22. Presumably, you've always had a passion for Louisiana food.
Oh, yeah. You know, I lucked out as just a chef because I have a mentor. He's a famous chef by the name of Chef John Foles, who's like an ambassador for Louisiana cuisine. And he took me under his wing whenever I was 16 years old and I got to travel the world. And he is an absolute historian of Louisiana cuisine. And it's something I love because there's so much tradition in what we do. So to be able to experience that and learn from him was as a chef, I mean, the most amazing thing.
And for listeners in the UK, of course, which is a prime audience initially, although podcasts, obviously people can listen to all across the globe, really. Brian, what best recipe tips or ideas would you actually have for somebody who wants to maybe try before they take that journey across the Atlantic?
The interesting part about Creole cuisine, a lot of how we cook is about developing flavors. And so when you think of traditional dishes coming out of South Louisiana, typically you're talking gumbos or etouffees. And a lot of it is based in the preparation of a dark roux, where we're taking our oil and our flour, but we're cooking it to the point where the flour begins to toast and gets a quite nutty aroma to it. We then always add in a trinity, which is a onion, celery, and bell pepper, finish that with garlic. And then you can take that simple combination of a dark roux with trinity and take it in a myriad of directions, oftentimes into a gumbo, sometimes into a stew or an etouffee. So I think part of introducing yourself to Creole cuisine is starting with a dark roux and trinity.
So your mouth's already watering. That was I thinking that the jambalaya was simply a song by the Carpenters, and you're probably too young to remember the Carpenters and jambalaya, but there we are. Let's just turn briefly back to our ace executive chef, of course, Jeremy. What's your own personal favorite Nouvelle Louisiane food?
Well, I mean, yeah,
or is that too tough a question? Is it a case of there's
so
much
choice? Hard question for a chef. But no, I'll tell you this. Still to this day, jambalaya is probably one of my favorite just classics to cook. There's something soulful about browning off my diced pork butt, then sauteing and browning off my andouille sausage, then adding my onion, celery, bell pepper, garlic, stewing that down, developing all those flavors, adding the stock, adding the rice. I love it. Now, with that said, as a chef and someone who's creative as well, probably the most fun I have in the kitchen is coming up with something new. Well, what I absolutely love about my job is I can be driving into work one day for whatever reason, or be in the shower, get inspired by just whatever. So I can get an idea. I can get the ingredients together. I can prepare it all, serve it that night as a special, interact with the guest and see what they thought about it. And when they love it, there's not a better feeling in the world. It's one of the most satisfying parts of the job. And I can do that constantly. So doing something new and being creative is also a great pleasure as well.
It sounds a bit like jazz, but actually for the taste buds as opposed to for the ear, which is extraordinary. So great stuff there. Of course, to mention that Hummus House Plantation is, according to Esquire magazine, one of the top 20 best new restaurants in America. So congratulations on that. I'm sure we'll be heading ever onwards. Brian, where can people go to find out further information about the Louisiana Seafood Cook-Off and indeed what we've been talking about today in terms of the National Geographic Food Festival?
LouisianaTravel.com is going to have all the information you need about the wonderful cuisine in South Louisiana, how to get to us, and all of the other interesting aspects to explore in our wonderful state.
And how did it feel like, Brian, when you were a cook-off winner for the Louisiana Seafood Cook-Off? Was it a case of a highlight of your existence, or was it a case of, just another day at the office?
A little bit of both. You know, anytime you get the opportunity to represent your city and your state through something you're extremely passionate about, which is cooking, it's a wonderful day. And the fact that we just have such impeccable ingredients to start with, sometimes it almost feels like cheating.
There you go. Brian Landry, Louisiana Seafood Cook-Off winner and New Orleans native. New Orleans. Huge thanks. Many thanks indeed. And also Jeremy Langlois. Hopefully we've got the pronunciation there. It is Langlois.
Man, you nailed it.
Then, well, we'd just like to ensure that things there. Otherwise, how could we ever watch another episode of CSI New Orleans again, basically? Jeremy Langlois, executive chef, and Brian Landry, as I mentioned. Huge thanks. And keep up the excellent work.
Great chatting with you.
Now, it's fair to say that with heat waves striking through the country and indeed going across the globe, the challenges of traveling could be enhanced with a whole range of aspects. And one of the things we don't like to go down with is obviously an upset tummy. So to actually address ways in which we can look at good gut health, we've not just got one, but two fabulous individuals today. First of all, the awesomely talented Dr. Sarah Jarvis, MBE, back as ever. How are you, Sarah?
I'm always fine and all the better for talking to you, Alex.
Well, splendid. And of course, we also have registered dietitian Imogen Woolsey with us. How are you, Imogen?
Hi, Alex. I'm good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Delight. Now, Sarah, if we come to you first, what are the most common complaints that people actually have when they travel abroad? I mean, we used to hear, obviously, the old music hall references to upset tummies and getting the trots and various other sort of aspects. Mm-hmm. It's quite a serious concern, though, isn't it?
It really is. And in fact, 2 in 5 Brits, more than that, have had a holiday ruined by a bowel problem, whether it be diarrhea or constipation. We know that at least 1 in 7 people suffers from constipation at some point. And it's much more common if you're going abroad, because, for instance, you may be drinking less fluid, you may be getting dehydrated, you may be drinking more alcohol, which can both dehydrate you and lead to some fairly iffy decisions in relation to what you're going to put in your mouth in terms of what you're going to eat. But of course, irritable bowel syndrome is also a really, really common problem. At least 1 in 5 people will have problems. Some of the symptoms of irritable bowel, which can include tummy pain, colicky tummy pain, bloating, and a change in your bowel habits. Some people, particularly women, they get IBS more commonly, will have diarrhea. Some will have constipation, and the really unlucky ones will have a combination of the two. And any change in your lifestyle can bring on symptoms of IBS.
Imogen, clearly the series of instances that Sarah's actually referred to does impact a whole variety of other bits and pieces. What's the best solution then? Is it just a case that we need to be very careful in terms of what we eat? Do we take our own? I mean, I've seen various cases where people have actually tried to ferry their own food abroad from that point of view. Do they get their own personal chefs and so on? What is the solution?
Yeah, so gut symptoms, there's no one clear fix solution. It's about an influence from so many different things. And obviously, when you're going abroad, you want to think ahead and have put your mind at ease by doing a bit of planning. And if you know that your gut is prone to playing up a bit, you may want to pack a bit of a toolkit with you. And that may include something like a probiotic. Simpreve is a water-based one, but there are many others out there. And when you are traveling, I think just considering when you're visiting places, are there toilets around, you know, just making sure that you've got, you've got the knowledge you need so that you actually feel less anxious, because anxiety also can impact your gut symptoms. And then you go around in a circle.
And Sarah, that certainly seems to be pretty much the case, that people are quite embarrassed, obviously, about talking about faecal matters, shall we say, as opposed to poo disasters. But in terms of that sequence, again, it's the quality of the holiday, and it's the quality of our own sort of lifestyle that can really be impinged. I mean, there's really sort of a big impact on our whole experience with this.
Oh, it absolutely can. In fact, if we look back at this survey, we know that, you know, nearly half of people admit to avoiding certain activities on holiday, a quarter don't eat certain foods, 1 in 6 won't take long car or train journeys. So I'm not remotely surprised that people do struggle. And of course, I think this largely goes back to childhood, you know, all the poo and loo jokes, all the things about smells and so on. It's not really surprising, but it is really important that people recognise that they need to be prepared beforehand. As Imogen has said, it may well be that you would be thinking about, for instance, finding out where the loos are. There are often, if you go to different places, you might find that supermarkets, toilets, tourist information centres, fast food restaurants have loos. But have you checked that you've got your own bathroom in your loo? Have you checked if, for instance, you do want to take a water-based probiotic like Simprove, which is fine before it's open, but once it's opened, it needs to be kept in the fridge. Have you checked that you've got a fridge in your own hotel accommodation? So there are all sorts of things that you can do.
That Imogen is clearly part of this DIY survival kit, actually ensuring that you do look after your Simprove. It's not just a case of, as Sarah said, that you opened it up and then it's okay, I'll try it in about a week's time. It's not going to work, is it?
No, absolutely not. Simprove needs to be stored in the fridge once you've opened it. But as Sarah pointed out, before it's opened, it's fine. So what you could do is just put it into your luggage that you check in. And then once you get to your destination, just locate wherever the fridge is. And if you've got one in your room, then that's perfect.
It's worth noting as well, Sarah, that although we're talking about possibly holidays overseas, these tips and advice pretty much refer to the current conditions we're experiencing in Britain, basically, because you want to ensure that you're not going to sort of head off to some part of the country where you should and then go down with diarrhea, for instance.
No, absolutely. And of course, we are not in developing countries, so you don't need to take quite the same precautions. For instance, if my patients are always going off to anywhere outside Western Europe or the USA or Australasia, then I would always suggest that they think about the mantra, boil it, peel it, cook it or forget it. And that, of course, also applies to, say, homemade ice creams. If you've got a bottled drink and then you're going to put ice in it, then that could be contaminated. And the last thing you want is a nasty bout of traveller's diarrhoea to ruin your holiday. And at least that's not usually an issue in the UK. But yes, you're quite right. There are other issues, including I'm on holiday, I'll drink lots of alcohol.
Yes, I mean, we keep coming back to that, and it's not good for you in a variety of ways, but we'll discuss that at another time, perhaps. Imogen, from your own perspective, have you ever actually suffered yourself from any of these challenges?
Oh, completely, yes. I mean, last week I was in Cyprus, and I actually, it was really weird, came back from 30 degree heat to 30 degree heat back in the UK. But yeah, hydration was a massive thing for me, and I do suffer from IBS myself. So I was really conscious to carry a water bottle around with me and make sure I keep sipping it, and take breaks out of the sun as well, because it is really, really, it can be really punishing when you're out there all day.
That's another key thing, presumably, Sarah. You don't necessarily want to actually just glug down several pints of water at the start of the day and think, it's all right, I'm sorted. It's kind of sipping regular and often, presumably.
It really doesn't work that way. And of course, there are some people who are more vulnerable to dehydration. So pregnant women, very small children, older people, all people with underlying health conditions, people taking water tablets, all of them are more prone. But quite frankly, everybody, it's an issue for everybody at the moment. I believe the heat in the UK is higher than it is in Barbados, which really tells you everything you need to know.
And any reason in terms of why we are so embarrassed about this? I mean, you mentioned it's due to kind of like childhood habits and various other bits and pieces, where flatulence is seen as like the number one amusing thing in all sorts of ways, that, you know, irritable bowel syndrome. Are we getting better at kind of saying, look, you know, I really have got an upset stomach?
I wish I could say that we were, interestingly. Probably a significant proportion of people, even who have accidents, for instance, will not mention it to their doctor unless their doctor specifically asks. And yet, you know, that's got to have a major impact on your life. We know that a huge number of people have irritable bowel syndrome. We know that a significant number of people, of course, have inflammatory bowel disease, such as Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. And yet, you know, we talk about our bedroom habits these days, apparently on social media all the time. But when patients come in and see me and I ask them about their bowels, have they had any blood, for instance? You know, we do all need to be aware. The sad death of Deborah James, she did the most extraordinary job in raising awareness. And we all need to be thinking about, have we had a change in our bowel habit? Have we lost weight without meaning to? Have we got tummy pain, particularly if it's accompanied by blood in the poo, and particularly if that poo isn't bright red and on the paper or in the pan, it's dark red, it's mixed in with the stool, or you've got black, tarry stools. All of those things, and being off your food for no obvious reason, are things that you must be making steps to speak to the doctor about. And yet, I am astonished at how many people will wait before they come and see me.
Imogen, if people are looking for further information on sanitation when travelling, where would you point them?
So I'd point them towards our Simproof website. We've launched a campaign recently called It Takes Guts, which is exactly designed to sort of break the taboos around talking about bowel health. And on our website, we do have lots of lovely articles and blog posts that can help people find out information before they go travelling and put their mind at rest.
And Sarah, likewise, in terms of actually having general good health and good gut health, presumably there are lots of sort of locations you go to. Is there anything that you'd particularly suggest?
Absolutely. So the simproof.com website really does have a host of information. In addition, for instance, if, say, you've got Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, their website, you can get hold of one of their can't wait cards in case you need the toilet urgently, and they're available in 30 languages. So there are all sorts of tips you can take, and you can find out details, for instance, of toilet mat apps in other countries from the IBD Passport website. So there are all sorts of things that people can do depending on what symptoms they have. But largely, it's a question of being prepared and taking sensible precautions when you're there.
as ever, a fact-packed feature, basically, Sarah, as we knew it would be. So we'll wrap up with those two final questions. What the hey, it's tradition. Sarah Jarvis, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
I've had a very interesting Zoomer, and yes, of course, Alex, I would be delighted to return.
Ah, splendid. And Imogen, your debut on the Madrid Drive, has it been good for you?
It's been fabulous, yes, absolutely.
Excellent. And will you be back with us sometime in the not-too-distant future?
If you'll have me, yes, please.
Imogen Wolseley, dietitian, and of course, Dr. Sarah Jarvis, GP extraordinaire. I would say, actually, I'm surprised. I'm just a little disappointed, Sarah, you haven't actually put in for the leadership of the country, actually. I thought you might have a few nominations for that, but what the hey.
I think I have better things to do.
Well, there you go. Dr. Sarah Jarvis, MBE, huge thanks. Stay safe and have some great holiday travelling.
Bless you.
Fatigue, achy joints, painful periods, dizziness, hot flushes, stomach cramps, nausea, vomiting, or indeed UTIs. Now, all of those are symptoms. And one of the challenges, of course, of medicine is how you actually look at those symptoms and then actually give an appropriate diagnosis so that the prognosis can actually work out well for the patient. But it does seem as though we need to rethink some of the ways in which perhaps artificial intelligence can actually help with that, and ways forward within that whole process, and to address this particular topic, and also to avoid the challenges of being misdiagnosed. We're delighted to welcome the lead GP at Livy, the digital healthcare specialist. That's wonderful, Dr. Bryony Henderson. How are you, Bryony?
Hello, Alex. Very well, thank you. Thank you for having us on this morning.
Well, good to connect with your good self. Now, clearly, some of those lines I've just said in terms of the symptoms that can obviously lead to all sorts of things. It's very easy for us. I mean, not just trained GPs, but I think anyone to actually make snap decisions and say, oh, you've obviously got this. This is what it's all about, etc. Really staggering to find that new research has revealed that medical data bias is indeed failing women in particular, with over half women feeling that they have been misdiagnosed.
Absolutely. You're quite right, Alex. So 57% felt misdiagnosed, and a staggering 22% felt that it was due to them being female. So there's really a sort of big disparity that women face when it comes to healthcare, and a wide gap in the treatment of women compared with men. And we're trying to start that conversation. We want to drive change through education. And we're doing this in two ways. Firstly, with a ebook, which is actually written for everybody and anybody to read by healthcare experts, but also for doctors with free training, not only for our own GPs, but thousands of GPs throughout the country.
I really hadn't realised that up until really the back end of the 20th century, almost all medical research was carried out exclusively on men. I suppose if that's the case, then it's not surprising that actually there has been a bias towards men, because obviously they've been that's the gender that's been most analysed.
Absolutely, you're quite right. It's until, as you said, very recently, and that's perpetuated even till today. So if we look at heart attacks, for instance, women are 50% more likely to receive the incorrect initial diagnosis. So there really is a disparity. There's a wide gap which does need addressing. The conversation needs to start now.
I mean, the list of symptoms we started this particular piece with, again, almost a third of misdiagnosed conditions were related to women's health. As we said, those were the top symptoms, basically fatigue, achy joints, painful periods, dizziness, hot flushes, and so on. Is it because, again, there have been various narratives that have kind of crept into even the medical profession? They've said, oh, it's fatigue. It must just be the time of life, or other such things like that.
You're absolutely right. And I see a lot of patients, and I can give you an example in a second, where symptoms have been almost dismissed as normal for a long period of time. And, you know, just to pick up on that, just the other day, I saw a patient who had crippling period pain for the last 5 years. So much so that, you know, social life, professional life, all affected to an enormous degree. And her symptoms were always dismissed as normal by various doctors over that five-year period. Took her a lot of guts to seek a second opinion, which she has now done, diagnosed with endometriosis on treatment. And as a result, her words to me, she feels like a new woman. So this mental health cloud has lifted, in her words as well. And that's not unusual. And it was sadly, in my experience, not a unique story. Endometriosis, for instance, 1 in 10 women suffer with it. And there's an 8-year average lead time between symptoms and diagnosis. So it's this dismissal as normal, which we have got to address.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why Libby has partnered with best-selling author and podcaster Emma Gannon to actually create this Misdiagnosed. Would you like to just share with us, Brian, about Misdiagnosed and how this can be another step forward in avoiding the notion of, oh, I'm just being classified as a hypochondriac because I'm worried about this?
Absolutely. So it's a book that we want everyone to read, written by our health experts. Whether you're female, male, medical, non-medical, please have a look at it. It's free to download on our website. But you're right, Misdiagnosed, the health handbook every woman and man should read. And you're right, we've partnered with the wonderful Emma Gannon, who's written a foreword on the subject. But the book really discovers how symptoms differ from women to men. It outlines critical information. And I think most importantly, at the end, goes into advice on how to speak with your doctor from both in the primary care, the GP perspective, but also from a gynecologist perspective as well. How can patients get the most from their appointments?
I mean, there's an awful lot of technology that's actually out there, from smartwatches to other ways. And clearly the wealth of information and often misinformation that one can find through a general survey on the World Wide Web. Are things getting better, Bryony? I mean, or is it a case of, you know, people are getting concerned about this? Or is it a case of, well, the more information we actually have, the better the chances of actually getting the right diagnosis will be?
And I think it's got to be the right information, hasn't it? You're right, the World Wide Web, massive, massive. And there is a lot of misinformation out there. So you need to make sure that the information that you are receiving is correct. And everything on our website certainly has been written, checked by a medical expert. So you know that the information contained within it is correct and accurate.
Still quite staggering to see that finding that almost a quarter believed that their misdiagnosis was simply due to their being female. I mean, really, that seemed, I would have thought that attitude would have gone out at least in the 1960s, but obviously not.
Well, and that's why we need to address it now. And I think, looking at another statistic, almost a third felt doctors were not properly trained in women's health. So in partnership with the book, we're also running training sessions for GPs, not only our own GPs, but thousands of GPs throughout the country. Now, we know GPs are horrendously busy. I practice as well. We're all busy. So we are recording these training sessions so that they can be viewed when it's convenient for that doctor.
So I was going to say, the additional stress factor on GPs, we ran a feature earlier this week about the need for pharmacists to actually take on board some of the load with respect to that. So do you think it's a case of maybe rolling out that communications mechanism so that actually health professionals per se actually are aware that if somebody just says, oh, I got a hot flush, etc., that they don't suddenly make an instant snap decision?
Oh, absolutely. And that's why the training is so critical. We can empower women with our books and information. But the second half of that is very much training for GPs, making sure that GPs are comfortable with women's health, prescribing HRT, diagnosing women's health conditions as well.
And finally, Bryony, where can people actually go to find out further information about Libby and indeed this particular project?
Brilliant. So the best place is our website. So www.libby.co.uk/women's-health is where our ebook is contained. But within that, you'll find a whole host of information about all sorts of medical conditions.
Dr. Bryony Henderson, lead GP at Libby, digital healthcare specialists. Huge thanks, and continue your excellent work.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Just standing there, and I thought I was only dreaming, yeah. I kissed you then, and then once again. Doctor, doctor,
such delight. We all leave before morning light. Please don't go. No, please.
Okay, so there's a cost of living crisis going on. We know that. We know that that's case in point. However, how do we actually translate that to what we are purchasing in the shops? With new research from Red Tractor and YouGov revealing a significant drop in consumer trust across almost all British institutions, clearly there are key areas to be addressed. So we're delighted to welcome to the programme to share some of the findings of this survey and indeed possibly put some pointers in the direction of how we need to go to restore trust in British product. The chair, of course, Red Tractor, that's the fabulous Christine Takeon CBE. How are you, Christine?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you. And that's a very, very good summary. Well done.
Well, it is interesting insofar as clearly we've just recovered from a holder of the Prime Minister's office who, shall we say, polarised people in all sorts of ways. But this lack of trust in terms of what certainly in recent years was seen as very much the standard bearer of good quality British food, that's really quite problematic, isn't it?
Yes, I think there has been a fall in trust in every British institution, and the three most trusted British institutions are first water, second NHS, and third is our food. But there's been a fall in trust in everything, which I think is just a general dip in morale, which is sad. But there is no reason for people's trust in food to decrease. And it seemed to be coming from about a quarter of people said they were having to, well, half people said they were changing what they were buying, but a quarter of them were trading what they perceived to be trading down, trading from branded to own label or own label to basics. And they felt that as a result of that, they couldn't trust their food. And I I feel quite indignant about this, because British food that is, you know, it's supported by legislation. And then in addition to that, we've got Red Tractor, and we're visiting every farm every year and checking that they are up to legislative standards, and in many cases beyond, particularly in animal welfare. And I just wanted to reassure people that if it's got the Red Tractor on, it's exactly the same whether you're buying premium or basics. It'll be a different specification, maybe. It might be different. Might be. By that, I mean the premium product might have all of the carrots. We're in Lincolnshire, so this is a good example. It might have all the carrots exactly the same size. But in that field, there will have been some big carrots and some little carrots. And they get graded out, and they will be put in the basics packs. So you're getting exactly the same food. So there is no reason for people's trust in food to decline when their budgets mean they have to buy something different. And I don't want anybody to worry that animal welfare or the environment or the safety of the food is being compromised when they are so-called trading down or having to manage their budgets.
You raise a number of key points there, Christine. I mean, certainly animal welfare is something which we are very concerned about, and indeed have run features on the fact that here we are 200 years after Britain enacted as the first welfare animal welfare laws into practice. We're finding that actually now there are other countries, certainly when it comes to rearing chickens, etc., that are sort of way ahead of us. And I think these kind of narratives do feed into the challenges about, well, I don't know. I mean, I only like to have free range eggs. How can I actually guarantee that it is a free range egg as opposed to a battery reared chicken and so on? And again, that's another area which certainly the Red Tractor presumably has to address.
Well, what you're talking about there is food fraud, and the Food Standards Agency are very much on top of that. And the retailers themselves, I mean, this traceability that I talked about that Red Tractor stands for is really important, that we can trace back to the farms that the products have come from. And that's how you ensure as a retailer that if you're buying free range eggs, you're getting free range eggs. So I don't think that, you know, yes, it goes on and it's very, very small. On the whole, the food you're buying in supermarkets is completely traceable back to the farms. And with the Red Tractor logo on, that means we've audited that. We've checked the whole chain that it is traceable back to the farms. You know, it could be some of the stories that come out, but we audit 46,000 farms, and the solidity and the support and the robustness of Red Tractor is really important to guarantee that. And that's why all of the supermarkets insist that their fruit and vegetable is Red Tractor. That is their specification.
One of the ongoing debates, certainly as far as the Great Yorkshire Show over previous years, obviously excluding the pandemic years, and indeed the Lincolnshire Show used to focus on, is the fact that if we actually genuinely paid what food costs to produce, we would really be seeing substantial hikes in prices, etc. How do you balance the importance of the Red Tractor and the trust in food with ensuring that people don't make false economies and say, oh, well, actually, we'll just go for something which is a little bit random and take a chance?
I think that that's what the assurance mark means, that when it's on, you know, if they think they're taking a chance, it might be, well, I've never bought basics products before, or the value products. You know, I don't quite know what I'm doing. If they've got the Red Tractor logo on, they don't need to worry.
And that's the key thing to take away from this, of course. I mean, you talked about Lincolnshire, which is very much a producer of fantastic quality material. Yorkshire, likewise, we do produce some good stuff. In terms of actually seeing that Red Tractor logo, would you say it's actually vital that people, when they go shopping, if they're listening to this and they're about to have a shopping trip, that actually that's what they should be looking out for?
I think that's it. That's the message. My message for people listening at home is that if they've got the Red Tractor on the product, firstly, it tells you it's British. And secondly, it tells you that somebody has assured that they've audited those farms, they've checked all of the process the whole way through, and therefore they don't need to worry at all about the standards of animal welfare or environment or food safety. They've all been grown to our standards, which are strict. And particularly in animal welfare in the UK, we are quite a lot stricter than other countries because we love and care about our animals.
we exist on an island. I don't want to talk about Brexit, clearly, but do you feel as though, in terms of the way that we're coping with climate change and all sorts of other aspects within that, that actually the future outlook is still pretty bright when it comes to actually ensuring that the food that we're producing for ourselves is actually a good quality?
Yeah, very definitely. There is no way that, I mean, we are always under pressure at Red Tractor to tighten the standards, and we're trying to strike the right balance between what's feasible for farmers and what the public are actually asking for, and that obviously reflects on what the retailers ask for. So don't worry, the quality of British food is only going to go up, and is very solid. And I think that as we are allowing imports from other countries with our new trade deals into the UK, that means that if people are looking for British, they will know that it has been grown to standards that they have been asking us for.
And finally, Christine, where can people go to find out further details about the Red Tractor sign, assuming that there might still be one or two people out there who are still a little bit bamboozled and think, so what does that Red Tractor mean then?
There is a Red Tractor website. So just Google Red Tractor, you'll find it. And we have lots of little videos on there on how do they, which is, how does Red Tractor assure cheese? How do we assure rapeseed oil? How do we, so various products, including the wool that goes into Hypnos beds. So there's some quite interesting, what exactly does Red Tractor do? We've got some descriptions of that on our website.
Christine, it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with your good self. Keep up the excellent work. For now, though, Christine Takeon, CBE, Chair of Red Tractor, or indeed Food Czar. Any thanks indeed. Take care now.
Thank you.